Fourth of July speaker, all the way from Fresno, Leonard.
Leonard.
Thank you, Leonard.
Okay. Thanks, Justin. Well, good evening. My name is Leonard, and I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome the newcomers and all of those who are either new or feel new. I'd also like to thank Bill for inviting me to come and speak tonight. Bill and I go back a little ways. I think we met at a speaker meeting in Springville, if I'm not mistaken, somewhere. But you got called me up a number of years ago and asked me to come. So it's my second time back. But again, thanks, Bill, for the invite. And I'd also like to just start off by making a disclaimer in that I'm going to be talking about my story and my experience, and hopefully share some strength and some hope. But, you know, I'm not a spokesperson for AA. I will be sharing things that are AA and program related. You can bank on those, but I'll be sharing some opinions, and so you may not agree with them, but, you know, take what you need and leave the rest kind of thing. So, happy 4th of July. The 4th of July is my favorite non-religious holiday, you know, and I really do love this holiday because I am so grateful to live in a country that has the freedoms that we do, and we live in a country with tremendous freedoms. You know, we're not perfect, nobody is, but we are a very, very fortunate. And I'd also like to thank, if there are any here who have served in the military, and thank you for your service, and especially those who paid the ultimate price so that we could have our freedoms, you know. So we have a lot of civil freedoms and political freedoms in this country, but in AA, you know, we get to experience freedom too, you know. And I went to a meeting last night and got to share my sobriety date is July 3rd of 1996. I got to share my 22nd birthday. Thank you. I share that. No one's more impressed than I am. But I share that only because it was not anything. My job was to drink. And I'll share a little bit about that, but it was God's job to get me sober, and so I'm truly grateful to be sober today, but to be able to experience freedom, you know. And at that meeting last night, they read from the promises, you know, and we will experience a new freedom and a new happiness. So, just a very brief history about my drinking. I started drinking when I was 13. Came from a family that's heavily drinks, even today. There are a few of us in that family, but I didn't realize that there was a big difference between alcoholic drinking and heavy drinking. You know, and could be a heavy drinker and drink frequently, you know, and we show signs of being an alcoholic, but alcoholic drinking is very different. And alcoholic drinking demonstrates a lack of freedom. Even with the demonstration or the behaviors or the experience, you know, as an alcoholic, I didn't think I was an alcoholic, right? I had to come to that conclusion much later on, but I started showing signs early in high school. Once I got my driver's license, I was free. My first drinking experience was when I was 13. I was left to 10 bar, had a family wedding reception at the age of 13, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and I began to drink anything I could, and by the end of the night, I was walking around. There were phases where I couldn't remember. I had no idea that was called a blackout. I was trying to hit on the female drummer that was playing at 13 years old and pimply face. I actually thought I had a shot, and it was just, you know, the behaviors that I demonstrated in my drinking over the years continued to become worse and worse. But I got married at, by the time I left high school, I was had two alcohol-related accidents. Got married very early. My girlfriend became pregnant. We got married. So at the age of 21, I was a father. My wife was 19. And we proceeded to have another child a year later. And those are our only two children. But my wife and I'm married to an exceptional woman. She has stuck with me. She wrote it out with me. And she allowed me, and she was very interesting because I tell guys, you know, my story, and my wife did instinctively a lot of the things that are suggested to the wives. She never nagged me. She gave me the rope I needed to hang myself. And she took care of the kids. When I started drinking and we were with family, she knew, she would say, "I'm getting ready to take the kids." I said, "Okay, you know, someone's going to take me home." And of course, after everyone was ready to go to bed, I was still, you know, where's the after hours stuff? And then sometimes I'd get family to take me to the bar, and then I'd find the after hours stuff. And so I was just never done until I was done. And so that started to progress and get worse and worse. I had a few more accidents. And I'm not going to go into a tremendous drunkalog. It really serves no purpose. We all know if you're an alcoholic, you've got one, and it doesn't vary too much. You know, the details do, but the progression is there. I love Bill's story, by the way. I love to see, when we read this at Big Book Studies, how the illness of alcoholism progresses and gets worse and worse, never better. You know, that was my case too. So by the time we started showing some real red flags and having problems, my relationships were wearing. My kids really didn't want to be around me. Daughter that was very angry at me. And I had a boss that was trying to fire me. And I just thought he was being, you know, really petty about me coming in 15, 20 minutes late or, you know, leaving a little early and, you know, not being really present. And you know, but I was doing a good job, I thought. But he really wanted to fire me. And he took it to the end is where he could go. And he realized on a technicality, and I knew it, that he had asked me to perform an illegal action, a directive, and I refused only because, and I had done this many, many times before for him and other people, and so because of that, he thought he's going to fire me. Once I knew that I had it over on him, they dismissed me from that room. The lawyers were there, the whole nine yards, and I knew I had him, and I stood over his desk, and I looked at him, and I was telling him, I said, I think you're a poor boss. I used different words. I said, I think you're a poor boss. You know, I don't think you even know how to manage. I was that arrogant and that vengeful to be able to do that to him. I also started to have more and more distance with my family in my primary relationships. And like I said, my kids really didn't want to be around me, and I was doing things that was embarrassing them in front of their friends. And but in my mind, you know, I was just, it was, you know, the boss. You know, he was always riding me, and I needed, you know, I needed to relax. I needed to drink. And I can always remember driving home with that. Something else happened, and I was extremely, and the character defect of being hypersensitive. I mean, he couldn't even look at me without me getting angry. You know, that's how overly sensitive I was, and really not really able to function well socially. So those relationships were burning and getting worse and worse. But I would drive around in the country, and I'd start drinking and come home sometimes, most of the time, sometimes not. One time I remember I worked in Fresno, I lived in Kingsburg, and I came home by way of like Lemoore and Hanford and Porterville. And as I was driving around and being pissed off at my boss for something he may have said, something he may have done, and I was having these out loud arguments with him. I was planning my retaliation. I had no idea this was called resentment. But this anger that I had toward him was just pouring out of me, and it would just come out, and I'm sitting there. Nowadays, you can, you know, with Bluetooth and everything, you can act like you're making a phone call and be angry and yelling at your boss. But at that time, I looked like a crazy guy. You know, but I would drive in the country. Amazingly, I never killed anybody, and nor did I receive accidents. I don't know why, but I never got a DUI. I was pulled over. I had open containers. I had numerous times, and I was let off every single time. And I've shared that story with a lot of guys, and one guy just told me, he goes, you were one of the, I haven't met many of you guys. He was an old timer from LA who lived in our area. He says, you're one of those protected drinkers. I said, what? He said, yeah, you're a protected drinker. And I said, I have no idea what he meant, but it was true. You know, the things that I was able to get off of, and driving like an unguided missile out in the country. I remember I was coming home. I came out of a blackout. My speedometer read 80 miles an hour. I look up. I'm in a country road in the fog, and all I can see is white in front of me. I'm just flying down the road. I blacked out again. I have no idea. I came to the next day. I have no idea how I got home. I'd always take those little ceremonial, you know, trips around the car, you know, and I'd go out there and I'd act like I was, you know, checking stuff on the shelves and stuff, and I'd be looking back to see if I'd hit anything. And I became more and more fearful that one day I was going to come out and I was going to see a kid's bicycle or something impaled on the grill of my vehicle. So I remember having more and more fear about those kinds of things and the consequences. But even with that, knowing what the consequences were was not enough to stop me from drinking. I did not know at that time that I had a disease called alcoholism. I did not know that my freedom was impaired, that I did not have freedom, that alcohol had me. Alcohol did me. I did not do alcohol, but I didn't think that that was the case. I thought, you know, I just needed to try harder. And exert more effort, willpower, go light more candles at the church, you know, and during service, that kind of stuff. But I had made all these weird bargains with God to, you know, those 911 calls and then the I'll never do this again. And, you know, if you cure me of this, I'll do this, etc. And, you know, nothing was working. And but what I didn't realize is that I was really, really a sick person. And by the time I came in and was ready to come into AA, I came out of a blackout. I don't even remember how I got there, but I ended up at the AA meeting in Kingsburg on a Saturday morning. And as I went in, I can remember the feeling like you're a failure. You're just a turd with eyes, in a more colorful way to say that. But I just felt this, what I come to learn is this spiritual bankruptcy. I felt so worthless. But I came into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and immediately I started identifying with people. I sat in the very corner and identifying with some of the things that the people were sharing. And not so much their experiences, but their feeling. Because I felt, and the way I described it early on, and I still today, is that I felt like a walking dead man. I felt like I was keeping things, you know, and working, spending a lot of energy to try to make things look like they were still okay on the outside. But on the inside, I knew I was, I felt empty. I felt dead. I felt terribly lonely. The loneliness that I felt, I could be in a room like this and be talking to people and smile, but on the inside, I was dying. I could be laying next to my wife in bed and be 100 miles away emotionally. And I can remember that sense of isolation. So I kept coming to meetings, but then I stayed sober for about a week, and then I was, you know, the white knuckling wasn't working anymore, and I drank again. And then I would try to go to meetings, and I was still trying to drink and go to meetings and manage that. And I can remember thinking, well, this is dumb. you know, you're either going to stop drinking or you're going to, you know, drink. So one of these has got to go. And I can remember making the decision, you know what, I'm going to drink. So alcohol took me back out, but it also brought me back in about 6 months later. I came back by way of a treatment program. And I went to an intake, and at the treatment program, they were very good. I went there because I said, well, AA didn't work. I tried that, you know. But I went to this treatment program that was very good. Right off the bat, they told me, they said, look, we're going to teach you a little bit about yourself. We're going to teach you a little bit about this disease called alcoholism. They said, but you're going to come here 3 nights a week on this outpatient program, and we're going to have you sign, get this get well card signed at meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's where you're going to find sobriety, long-term sobriety. And I was very grateful. I had a program that was very, very upfront with me. I do remember that. And they said, you know, we're going to come here. We're going to teach you a little bit. And I objected right away. It's like, you know, I came here so you guys, and in my mind I thought, I'm too busy. I'm still involved in one thing or another, you know, and I had all these objections. And the guy, and I told him, and he said, Leonard, he said, didn't you say you'd be willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yes. He said, go get these cards signed and come back. So I'd bring them back. And there was a guy, the first counselor there, and he was really good. I liked this guy. Anyway, he started, they required us to fill out a rigorous honesty questionnaire. I'm going to bring it back. And I can remember filling that thing out. And one of the questions on there was, do you hide your drinking or do you drink alone? And the counselor looked at my paper. I brought it back. He goes, it says that you don't hide your drinking. And I said, nope. So I used to drink in front of any. I wasn't embarrassed. I drank in front of people. He goes, huh. And he'd already known some of my story because I'd been coming for a while. He goes, well, how about the different routes you would take home that you would pre-plan in your head because, you know, you wanted to take a different route home so you could stop at different liquor stores so maybe they wouldn't know you. I said, no, I go that way because I just don't want to take the same route every day. I mean, you know. And he goes, huh. He said, how about when you stuff cans, your empties, and you stuff them under the seat of your car? Isn't that hiding your drinking? And I said, no, that's just being prudent. If I get pulled over, you know, it'd be stupid for me to just want to leave cans out. I got to, you know, it's, you know, come on. I stuff them under my seat. It's no big deal. He goes, so that's not hiding your drinking? I said, no. He goes, huh. He said, how about when you come home and you tell your wife when she asks you how many you had to drink on the way home and you tell her you had 2 beers, but you don't tell her that you had 2 tall 32-ounce Schlitz malt liquor bulls, and which have about the same effect as a six-pack. He says, that's not hiding your drinking? I said, no. Huh. He said, how about you don't drink alone? How about when you drink in the garage and you have all that alcohol, that beer you keep out there in the garage when you're doing projects or whatever? And that's not drinking alone or hiding your drink? I said, no. I said, I'm just doing work. He says, yeah, but you do, you know, you fix a fence hinge and change a light bulb and it takes you a 12-pack. I said, that's not hiding your drinking? I was becoming less sure of my answers. I said, no. He goes, huh. He says, how about when you're driving home and you take all those empties out of your truck and you're throwing them out on the country roads in this big pile so that, you know, before you get home, that's not hiding your drinking? And I honestly said, no. I said, those poor guys that ride around on bikes and have bags and they have to ride a quarter mile to get a beer can, I said, everything's right there. Then they don't have to go drive so far. He goes, he looked at me and then he said, you know, have you ever been institutionalized for your drinking? I said, no. He said, you sure? I said, yeah, I've never been institutionalized for my drinking. He goes, you sure? I said, yeah. He didn't say anything, and he looked at me and goes, "What the hell do you think this is?" And so he asked me, he says, "Do you have any liquor in your home right now?" I said, "No." I said, "No, I don't have any liquor." He goes, "Think about it. Think about where you kept, do you have any liquor in your house?" I said, "No." I said, I don't." He said, "You sure?" I said, "No." I said, wait a second. I've got, you know what? I'm part of an organization. We have dinners and stuff. I have some champagne in cases in my garage. By the refrigerator where you store it? Yeah. Huh. He goes, "Think hard. Do you have any other alcohol anywhere in your house or your property?" Or anything? I said, "No." "Oh, wait a second. I got one can of Coors Light in that refrigerator." He goes, "One can of Coors Light?" I said, "Yeah, that's it. I mean, I don't know. He says, "You have a can of Coors Light in your refrigerator?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "I'll get rid of it." He said, "You ever hear the story of Superman?" I said, "Yeah, everybody's heard the story of Superman." He said, "Do you ever remember what it was that rendered Superman powerless?" I said, "Yeah, it was kryptonite." He says, "You think Superman has a 12-ounce can of kryptonite in his refrigerator, in his garage?" And I just kind of started laughing, and he goes, I said, no, I get it. I said, "I know where you're going with this." And no, he doesn't. He goes, "That's right. And he's Superman, and you're just Leonard." So I actually needed a guy like that to start pulling. You hear that term, pulling my covers. I hear a lot of new guys say, "Hey, what's that mean, pulling your covers?" You know, if you're standing naked under a blanket and someone pulls your covers, you're going to be very, very embarrassed, right? So what I've known and what I believe and what I appreciate even today is when my covers are pulled, when I'm standing in my own BS, right? I like the word denial. Especially when it's used as an acronym for the saying, D-E-N-I-A-L. Don't even notice I am lying. You know? And that is what denial will do for me. That's what this disease is. I can be and I can think that I'm a certain way, but my perceptions are so screwed up that I actually need people that are willing to expose me. Okay? And I'm very, very grateful. I've had a sponsor that's been willing to do that over the years. As I mentioned, I started going, once I got into that treatment program, I started going back to meetings in Kingsburg. I found a sponsor in Fresno, and he worked me through the first three steps. And I had him for, first of all, because they made me in the treatment program to get a sponsor. And I didn't even, you know, man up and go up and ask somebody. I just kept putting out that fishing hook. I'm kind of in need of a sponsor. So finally this guy comes up. He says, "You know what? I'll be your sponsor. I'll be your..." And I said, "Okay." So he started. He helped me out. You know, and this is a guy that I didn't have anything really in common with. Good guy, older guy, but we were very different. And he ended up... when I started going back to meetings and started, and this is my experience, it doesn't have to be anybody else's, but when I started going to meetings and started trying to talk about what was going on inside of me, but that loneliness and isolation and all that stuff that was knotted up, and I couldn't choke it out. I would start crying. And it was so painful for me to do that because I was very ashamed of that. Because from where I came, you didn't do that. And you didn't cry. That was a cardinal rule, you know, and I did. If in my family, if you did what I was doing in meetings openly, you know, you got called derogatory names referencing female anatomy. I mean, it just was not something you did. And I ended up choking stuff out and getting it out there. One old timer came up to me after a meeting, and he said, "You're 9 feet tall." And I was standing there, and I was exhausted, because anytime I purged like that, I was just feeling exhausted. And he goes, I looked at him, he goes, "You're 9 feet tall. You keep doing that, young man. You keep doing that, you're 9 feet tall." And he walked away. His name was Johnny M. from Reedley. And you know, he was a good guy. And I ended up meeting my second sponsor in Reedley. First sponsor got me through those first three steps. But before I changed, I went and did my third step with him. And he had asked me to write about some things. And I can remember writing about them. And I was writing about, and I had referenced something about my dad and, you know, the history there. And I was sitting there reading my writing to him, and I was choking this stuff out, and I was in between sobs. I had boogers running down, mucus, and I was just a mess. But I finally got it all out there, and I was embarrassed to look up. And I can remember just, it was quiet, and he just kind of let me gather myself, and I got my breathing back, and I looked up. And this guy that I had nothing in common with, this ex-felon, convict, older guy, I was younger at the time, but this guy's sitting there and he's crying. He said, that's a good job, young man. That's a good job. And they told me early on, don't try to do... Did you make any major changes in your life in the first year? Well, I went right back to school my second year of sobriety and the second month of sobriety and got extremely busy. And I started on my fourth step, which then took, I wouldn't suggest this, but this is what I did. I ended up taking a long time to get that done. And so I asked another guy in Reedley at the meeting I was going to, one of the meetings I was going to, if he'd sponsor me, because it seemed like when he shared, I really liked what he shared, and I could identify with him. So I asked him to be my sponsor, and he said, sure. He said, you know, you've got two kids that are the same age. I've got a son that's the same age as your son. And he started saying all this stuff, like, how do you know that? But he was listening to me when I shared. And it made me realize, hey, well, this guy maybe cares, you know. And so I continued to, he gave me instructions on what to do on my fourth step. But he never pushed me, you know. And he never pushed me, forced me, anything, you know. And finally, I was coming up on my second birthday. I was still going to school. I was finishing that up. And my second year birthday was about 6 months away. And I thought, you know, I need to get this done. And so it was more of out of false pride than anything else. I think I wanted to get that done. So I got busy and I finished that. And I called my sponsor. I said, hey, Tom, I said, I'm ready to read this to you. And he goes, good. He says, Leonard, I've been waiting for this call for a long time. I said, so good, let's get together. So we did that, and we went through it, and I belong to a particular faith community, same one that I was raised in. And I remember talking to him many months before that, the reading of my fourth step to him in my inventory, that it seemed to me that stuff that I was doing in church wasn't working. And I was ready to give all of that up because it seemed like there was a solution here. And people seemed to be relatively happy and useful. And if I've been self-deluded, then, you know, I'm going to give up the religion thing. You know, I was raised Catholic. And he said, and I told him what my thoughts were, which is always a good thing to do with your sponsor, share your thoughts with them. And he said, Leonard, he said, you've been going to church all your life. AA has no problem with you going to church. But whatever you do, don't substitute church for AA, because they're not the same. And what he was saying was that don't start reaping the benefits of, you know, staying sober consecutive days and then make a decision, hey, you know what, I don't need AA anymore, I'm going to go just do church. And I took his suggestion, and I continued to practice my faith. And it's really amazing to me today how much more I appreciate my faith today than I did when I was drinking. How come it wasn't working before? Well, I was a sick man, and I didn't know I was a sick man. The second meeting I went to, I heard a guy in Fresno at the Ilano Club say, you know, we're not bad people that need to get good, we're sick people that need to get well. And I felt some relief from that, just knowing that I was not this bad person. So anyway, so I did worked my steps with my sponsor. He helped me apply the principles of this program to my daily life. My daughter, I was having problems with her. She was at the ripe age of 15 years old and very angry. And I was whining to him about, you know, our relationship. It's like walking down the hallway. It's like two magnets with the same poles. You know, try to bring them together. You feel this negative energy and blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there whining. He stopped me. He says, "Leonard." I said, "What?" He goes, "You want to be your daughter's friend or do you want to be your daughter's father?" I said, "Well, I want to be your father." He goes, "Good. That's the right answer. You can't be both. She doesn't need a friend. She needs a father. And sometimes it's not very easy." And so Tom helped me a lot. He also helped me with my boss and my relationship with my boss. And that boss hated me and I hated him. But he did something one time and he impugned my dignity. He said something that made me so angry, and it was something so stupid, but that I blew it up. My hypersensitivity, this character defect I have of being overly sensitive about what other people think or say or whatever about me. And he made a comment. He was trying to make a joke, and I took it personally. And so I wrote up this letter. I showed it. I happened to show it to. I went to my AA meeting on Saturday morning. I'd written that thing up right away, and I was going to send it to his boss and our next one. Anyway, so I happened to have a meeting with the priest at our church, and I was talking to him about something else. But then I showed him this letter, and he read it, and he goes, "Huh, that's a good letter. It's well written. You know, yeah, you should turn that in. You know, let me know what happens." And, you know, and I said, "Good, I got the church's seal of approval on this. I'm going to take this letter and send it off." And then I thought, this thought came, like, "Call your sponsor." So I said, "Oh, yeah, I should do that." So I called up Tom, and I said, "Tom, I got this letter." He goes, "Come on over tomorrow, Sunday afternoon, 3 o'clock, and we'll talk about it." And so I went over there, and he read it, and goes, "Oh, this is a good letter. It's well written. You kind of expressed, you know, how you feel." He said, "Now, I suggest you tear it up." I said, "Tear it up? I got the church's seal of approval on this thing, and, you know, I was going to turn this in tomorrow." He goes, "You think you have problems now? Turn that letter in and see how many problems you have." He said, "Look, Leonard," he says, "I've been a manager and owned my own businesses. If my employee gave me this, I'd look at it and say, huh. And I'd round file that thing. I'd crumple it up and throw it away." He said, "Your boss is at home. He's enjoying his life. You're here on a Sunday afternoon in my house." He says, "Your boss, Leonard, doesn't have a problem. You do. Okay?" He says, "Your boss, you think your boss really gives a F-bomb what you think?" He says, "He doesn't. So I suggest you, you've emoted, you've expressed yourself, now tear it up. I suggest you do that." And I was offended. I mean, I thought, you know, he was going to be on my side. But he actually helped me to be accountable and to start doing this thing called growing up. I didn't like hearing that when I was new. I was in that treatment program, and that counselor I told you about told me about that. He says, "Leonard, you're 36 years old, but you probably have the emotional development of about a 16-year-old right now." He said, "It's going to take some time, but you keep working in your program, come to meetings, and you will start growing up." Okay? So, anyway, that's how a sponsor can help. You know, we talked about working with others earlier in the readings, and that is absolutely true. It's integral as part of our program. You know, and then it came to making amends. You know, and I had to make amends to my boss. And I call him out for coffee, and clean up your side of the street, Leonard. Don't worry about anything he's ever. Don't try to justify or rationalize, or, you know. So I went out and I called him, and we sat down, and I explained to him what I was doing. And he just looked at me. He had this glassy stare, but he would check out when I talked to him before, and I just thought, oh, he's not even here right now. And he was thinking as I was sharing with him. And then I stopped, and he goes, "You know, my dad used to be really strict with me. And it wasn't easy with me." And then I started listening to his inventory, And I wasn't prepared for that. And it was just, I listened, and it was like this awkward silence, and then, okay, let's go back to the office. And so we went back. But that action slowly started a process of healing. When I left there, a few years later, he and I had a pretty good relationship. Professional relationship. It was different, but we had a good relationship. I went into teaching, and I saw him about a year later at a workshop, and he was taking photographs, and I went up to him and I said, hey, how's it going? He goes, hey, how are you? I said, you know, I want to tell you that you were a good boss. I said, you tried to help me to be a better person and a better employee. And I want to thank you for that. And he got misty. He got kind of choked up a little bit. And he came over and he walked over. He got a smile. He gave me, he turned red. He gave me a big hug. And he says, hey, we grew together. That would not have happened had it not been for the actions and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I decided and was asked to run for office in my small community, and I accepted. And as soon as I accepted, I thought, what the heck are you doing? You're starting to make your direct demands. You're going to start talking to people here in this community, and then it's going to get in the paper, and blah, blah, blah. So my head started taking off, and then I remembered, am I willing to do whatever it takes to get sober? And if I need to lose esteem in the eyes of community members, so be it. I need to do this. And so I went to one of my amends was to an employer that I had, owned a supermarket, and I worked there. And I stole a lot from him. I would steal lots of alcohol. I'd hide it in milk crates. I'd put it out in the back, and I'd come back and get it. And I was pretty popular with my friends, and we ended up drinking a lot of his stuff, and I would steal things on break. I'd just grab a milk, and so I had to make an amends, and I had to figure out about how much it was, and I wanted to pay him. I had a little, figured in some interest, and so I went and I met with him, and I said, hey, I said, Billy, how you doing? I said, can I talk to you? He goes, yeah. I said, you know, you were a good boss, and you helped me out at a time when I really needed some. But I stole from you, and it was wrong, and I apologize, and I'd like to make that up to you. He goes, what? I said, I need to pay you back. He goes, well, how much is it? And I told him, and he said, you know what? He said, take that money and do something nice for your family. I said, no, I need to pay you back. This is something I really need to do. He goes, no, you'll pay me back. He says, that's how you'll do it. Do something nice for your family. He said, you remember Chuck? Now, Chuck was my hero because he was much older. He's with my oldest brothers and sisters. Came from a family of nine. I was number 7 out of 9. So he said, you remember Chuck for produce? And I said, yeah. Now Chuck and I, on our breaks, I'd jump in my car, we'd take off, we'd go to Art's Liquor Store, he'd buy a half pint, I'd buy a half pint, and I was sitting there drinking on mine, and I'd look over and I looked at Chuck, and all I saw were three big bubbles just go, boom, 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 and I thought, man, I wish I could drink like that. And so he was kind of like my hero, and I remembered Billy saying, my boss, well, former boss saying, you know, yeah, you remember him? I said, yeah. He goes, you know, funny thing about him, you know, about 3 weeks ago, he came in and did the same thing you're doing. And Chuck actually did become a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he and his wife moved up to Seattle a number of years ago. But, you know, it's funny how, you know, our lives are intertwined, and kind of appreciate the fact that my higher power has a sense of humor, too. But today, you know, I get to be in service, in AA service, and I sponsor guys, and I have a number of them wanted to come, but one family events, and the ones in my sponsors in Pismo, and anyway, it didn't work out. But last time they came, But I also do H&I service, you know, go into the county jail in Fresno and carry the message. And so me and our group, there's about seven of us that commit to Thursdays there. And so we go in and fill in and carry the message into the institutions because, you know, there's a couple of places in the big book. In Bill's story, I think it's on page 14, and then the milk experiment guy, I can't remember what page that's on, but in both of those it talked about, you know, being able to make it through the times and the trials, but making sure that as it was read earlier, that getting us through those difficult periods in our life, you know, would require being able to carry this message and be of service to other alcoholics. That will get us through those difficult times, you know. And so we try to do that today, and because that's what will work. This disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It will come back. And, you know, I am not so terrible. I've learned I'm not so terribly unique and different that it won't happen to me. It will. I know it will. All I have to do is stop doing the things that got me sober and keep me sober. So it's not a life sentence or anything. I actually enjoy it, you know. And like my sponsor, when he was asking his sponsor many, many years ago, you know, how long do I have to keep coming to these meetings? His sponsor says, well, you have to keep coming until you don't have to come, and then you don't have to come anymore. So, you know, I don't have to be here, but I know I want to be here, okay? But I do know that it's directly related to my sobriety and my ability to maintain healthy relationships, fairly healthy relationships. As I mentioned, I was elected to serve in public office, exercise some civic duty. I couldn't get in front of a group of people a third this size without, you know, being able to. I just panicked. But, you know, all those self-centered fears and the neurotic stuff, you know, it's all gone away. It's just by simply doing things, this simple spiritual program, this blueprint for living that we have called the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, has given me the ability to just be an ordinary person, you know, an ordinary citizen. I ran in Fresno and I won that office and served for 4 years. And then I wanted to take off because my mom was getting up there in years, and I had just changed and started working in another school, and so I thought I'd just not run for re-election, and I'm glad I didn't, because within that year my mom died, and you know, so I was able to be there with her when she died. When my dad died in 1985, I was out ripping and running. My wife and I were separated. I was involved with another woman, and so I got to be there with my mom. I got to watch, be with her as she expired, as she breathed her last breath, as we were praying in her presence. And what a blessing that was. That would not have happened without this program, without all of you, without having a relationship with God, the whole ball of wax. One of the brightest spots in my life in sobriety is becoming a grandpa. Now, you love your kids, you know, they're born, you love your kids, but it's different when you're a grandparent. And I was told that, and I just, whatever. But when my grandson was born, he was, we left the waiting room. It still hadn't hit me. But when we walked in, my wife was with our daughter during delivery, and she said, here he is. And as soon as she put him in my arms, it was over. I mean, literally felt like a lightning bolt of joy is what I experienced. And I cannot describe that any other way. It was, and I still delight in being a grandfather. We have a, he's now 10, 11. We have a granddaughter that's 2, and we have 2 identical twin boys on the way at the end of this month or beginning of August. So we're very happy about that. And that little grandson, he just transformed me at that time, and he couldn't do anything wrong. And if he did, I didn't care. And so at 2 years old, fast forward 2 years, and he's learning the word no, right? And he's swatting the television screen. I said, no. He stopped, he turned around and looked at me, and he dropped on his butt and threw himself back. His head hit the carpet. He just started wailing and crying and screaming. And this is the first time he'd ever done this. It's just, he just started throwing this like blood-curdling cry. And then he'd stop and he'd look at me to see if I was still looking at him. And then he'd start screaming and crying all over again. No tears, mind you. Just screaming and crying, having this tantrum. And I was watching him and I was thinking, wow, like he's trying to get his way. And even though he's acting like that, I was thinking, you know, when my kids would have done that, hey, get up off the floor, I'll give you something to cry about kind of thing. That's how I would have handled it back then. I was sitting there looking at him and thinking, how cute is that? He's trying to get his way. He's trying to use what worked before, but it's not working. So he's throwing this tantrum. And he's checking to see if I'm watching. And I remembered, I said, even though he's acting like that, I love him. I love him unconditionally. And that's when I heard this little voice inside. And it said, that's how I've loved you. And I've heard people talk about that stuff, but I experienced it. It wasn't a voice like you're hearing me now, but it was just this inner knowing that I was loved. And that I have a God that loves me unconditionally. I still am a goof up, but I have a God that loves me unconditionally. And I have this program to help me stay on track on a spiritual course that allows me to maintain that relationship and try to maintain that and do the next indicated right thing, you know, as best to the best of my ability. And to be in a relationship and healthy relationships with other people. So, you know, at that meeting that I went to last night, the promises were read. I'd like to read them again because I love them. And talks about working that, making those direct demands and working that ninth step. But it says that if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through the ninth step. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them. And like the fulcrum point on a teeter-totter, where it can go one way or the other, there's a little word in there that serves as the fulcrum point in that last sentence. And that's the word if. We will realize these promises if we work for them. So there's actions we take. I don't just get to sit here. Wherever I'm at, there's actions I can take to be involved and included and be just a part of. Alcohol will make me a part from. AA helps me to be a part of. Thank you for listening.